Day 150 of the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza. Claims and lives of more than 120 Palestinians. Israeli forces launch fresh raids in the occupied West Bank, killing another Palestinian and abducting tens of others. And Iran's interior minister says the ill-wisher's adverse propaganda failed to discourage Iranian people from going to the polling stations. Hello and welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned into World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. And unfortunately, as always, the top story is Gaza, where 150 days now into the Israeli onslaught on the Strip, and the regime has carried out more deadly attacks on civilian targets. The IOF has committed at least 13 crimes in Gaza during the past day, killing at least 124 people and injuring 210 others. Airstrikes on two houses in Rafah killed at least 17 more civilians and injured tens of others. Two more Palestinians also died in Israeli airstrikes on the Nusrat camp in central Gaza. Another horrific attack targeted a mass grave in Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. Well, according to eyewitnesses, body parts of the martyrs were scattered all around the cemetery after the attack. Israeli forces also stage fresh attacks on Khan Yunis, where they detain dozens of young Palestinians. Israeli-American genocidal war on Gaza has already left 30,534 Palestinians dead and nearly 72,000 injured. Meanwhile, Israel carries out another deadly raid in the occupied West Bank as part of the regime's intensified security crackdown in time with the onslaught on Gaza. Regime forces killed a Palestinian in their latest deadly incursion. While the raid targeted the Amari refugee camp in the central West Bank, regime troops also abducted 20 Palestinians in Al-Khalil. Israeli military also blew up an apartment in Nablus as part of the regime's stepped-up campaign to demolish Palestinian structures. Elsewhere in Tulkaram, Israeli bulldozers also destroyed the infrastructure at Nur Shams refugee camp. The regime has intensified its incursions across the West Bank since it began its ongoing genocide in the Gaza Strip on October the 7th. The raids and settler violence have left more than 400 Palestinians dead. Meanwhile, the 6th International Conference of Union of Resistance Scholars has been held in the Lebanese capital of Beirut. Muslim and Christian clerics from across the world have discussed concrete steps to support the people of Palestine and the resistance. Addressing the event, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem called the Al-Aqsa flood operation a legitimate move by Palestinians.
Al-Aqsa storm is a legitimate right of the Palestinians. There is no argument, no debate regarding its legitimacy. They confronted an occupation which continued for 75 years. This occupation cannot be removed except by resistance, and Al-Aqsa storm is the torch of life which feeds the resistance and contributes in the resistance increasing its presence and achieves victories via the steps it takes. This is a legitimate right. You are aware that were it not for the American support, the daily American support via the air bridge and funding via the weapons and ammunition which comes daily, and it has exceeded 250 planes up until now, and around 300 ships, all carrying ammunition and equipment. Were it not for this, Israel would not have succeeded in continuing for even days in its aggression.
In an address to the same conference, senior Hamas spokesman Osama Hamdan said the resistance will continue its sacrifices until the occupation of Palestine ends.
As the steadfastness and resistance on the ground continues from the resistance fighters and the people, we stress to the Zionists and to their partners, the United States of America, in this aggression. We say to them that what they failed to achieve on the ground, they will not be able to achieve politically. Whatever may be the misleading efforts and the pressures which are being exerted, this resistance will continue to be ready to sacrifice, will continue also to achieve more results and to build upon these results until the occupation comes to an end. It will continue to be committed to the norms and the principles of its people. Any flexibility we show in the negotiations out of our care for the blood of our people and to put a limit to the grave pains of our people and their sacrifices in the brutal genocidal war. At the same time, we are completely ready to defend our people. And the threats to carry out more massacres in Rafah, this once again proves the nature of this army with its this enemy, with this criminal army, which is represented, which represents one of the ugliest military seen by mankind in history, whereby they announce the massacres and the killing of the civilians as a strategy of war, and they launch attacks on hospitals as if they are bases.
Well, the Islamic resistance in Iraq says it has attacked the Israeli port of Haifa and the occupied territories in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza. The Iraqi resistance says it targeted a chemical facility in the port with a drone. It added that the operation was carried out in response to Israel's massacre of Palestinian civilians, including women and children in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out a number of attacks on Israeli targets in recent months. The group has also struck major American military bases in Syria and in Iraq amid anger over the U.S.'s support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. The IAEA chief says he is willing to visit Iran to discuss the course of collaboration with Tehran. Rafael Grossi made the request in a speech at the beginning of a meeting of the agency's Board of Governors. He said the agency has been unable to conduct extensive monitoring of Iran's nuclear work in the past 3 years. He also claimed that there has been no progress recently in resolving the remaining safeguards issues. He also said the agency has not found any evidence that Iran is producing nuclear weapons. Now, the agency has repeatedly confirmed the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program. Tehran walked back on some of its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal 3 years ago. That, in the wake of the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the deal and the failure of the three European parties of the deal to compensate for Iran's losses. Iran's nuclear chief has recently announced the IAEA's chief is scheduled to visit Iran in April. Well, Iran says the upcoming Jeddah meeting will be a test for the Organization of Islamic Cooperation regarding its commitment to the Palestinian cause. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says people in Islamic countries expect their leaders to take immediate and firm decisions to end Israel's brutal attacks on Palestinians. Nasser Kanani welcomed what Islamic countries have done for Gaza so far, but he stressed that Palestinians expect actions that would prevent the regime's atrocities. The OIC will hold an emergency foreign ministerial meeting on Tuesday to address the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. Iran's foreign minister will also take part in that meeting. Hello and welcome to this hour's news review. Iran has officially announced the final results of the country's major elections for parliament and the assembly of experts. The interior minister has hailed as glorious the massive turnout of Iranians despite months of psychological warfare launched by the enemies.
And also we had the propaganda ballyhoo launched by the enemies and the psychological warfares conducted by the enemy on the eve of the elections and even few months before the elections. Despite all these, one witnessed a massive turnout by the people, and there was a 25 million population taking part in the elections.
Vahidi says the enemy's unprecedented adverse propaganda failed to disappoint the Iranian nation. He added that Iranians dealt a great blow to the ill-wishers who sought to distance the people from the ballot boxes. Vahidi also underscored that the election organizers managed to maintain the morality and security of the elections on voting day, despite the enemy's attempts to foment insecurity and cast doubt on the validity of the vote. Over 25 million people turned out at the polls on Friday. Some 15,000 candidates vied for 290 seats, Majlis, the Iranian parliament. Now, hundreds of candidates also competed in the race for the 88-seat assembly of experts. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review, Gisu Misha Ahmadi and Sabir Abu Maryam, columnist and commentator out of Beirut. Well, thank you both for being with me. Let me start this off with Gisu. So, Gisu, you were present for the Interior Minister's announcement. Let's start from there. And overall, your assessment of what he said and how well the elections went or not.
Well, actually, Marzia, first let me start by confirming what the Interior Minister said in describing the election as a blow dealt to the ill-wishers of Iran. That was definitely the case. Let's not forget that in the lead-up to the election, there was a huge propaganda war launched against this election, and so many campaigns, obviously, from abroad, trying to discourage people, trying to point out problems that any society, Marzia, is dealing with. It's not just Iran that's dealing with some kind of economic problems or issues like that. These are not issues that should discourage people from taking part in the elections. And obviously, Iranians did show that in practice by turning out. 41% is actually a very good turnout for a parliamentary election. Let's define that. You know, Marzia, it's very different from taking part in a presidential election where there are only a few candidates and you have to pick one. In a parliamentary election, the process is more complicated. And in many cases and in many countries where they do practice this kind of democracy, the turnout is the same. And 41% is actually a good turnout considering the really large number of candidates that were taking part. 15,000 in Tehran, only 3,300 candidates for 30 seats. You know, that is a lot. And being able to choose from those and then, you know, take part in the election is in Iran not just a social duty, but it's also a religious duty. So many people do turn out to show their support for the Islamic Republic of Iran and also to do what they're supposed to do as a religious Muslims.
Okay, well, let me get Sabir in on this discussion. Your assessment of the importance of these elections, you know, it's very interesting that, as Gisu said, I mean, it wasn't a presidential election, it was a parliamentary election. But despite that, we saw unbelievable attempts as far as propaganda to make sure that the people do not go out, to make sure that the people became hopeless, to make sure that the people felt that it doesn't matter if you participate, it's not going to change a thing. So your overall assessment of what you saw on Friday?
First of all, I would like to say that the successful elections of parliament and the clerical board, it is a good achievement and a positive achievement of the Iranian nation. As always, Iranian nation standing with the right side of the history, and now again we observe that after all of the propaganda, even the many Western funded and Western governments backed TV channels, social media influencers, they were trying to manipulate, they were trying to hide the actual positions and the actual facts from inside Iran, but all are has been failed. And yes, let me say that this is the continuous sequence of the victories of the Iranian nation and especially Islamic revolution. The failure of the sequence of the failures of the Western governments, especially Europe, which is the most criminal and the biased government in the world, which is supporting the inhuman acts across the globe, especially against the Palestinian people and supporting Zionist regime Israel. So now 41% and more than 41% turnout is a very good turnout, and we are hopeful about this turnout. Maybe in future, in the presidential election, I hope this turnout will be increased, because the people of Iran, the nation of Iran, is awakening, and they are very much aware about the conspiracies, conspiracies against themselves, which are created by the United States of America. Mm-hmm. America. Well, let me say one more thing here. I do suggest to the American government, especially to the Biden, you must care about the Zionist regime. There is a collapse about the Zionist regime, and we are witnessing that they are demanding the elections before the time. So why you don't care about your puppets? Why you are against always you are creating propaganda against Iran, Pakistan, and other Muslim countries? As same like in Pakistan, after election, United States trying to intervene in the election.
And Sabir, just final comments. I mean, your thoughts on this continual campaign to make Iranians feel hopeless, but then we see people turning out for the elections. Your overall thoughts. 1 minute, please.
Yes, I think I said that earlier, that this is the victory of Iranian nation, and this victory must be protected by the Iranian nation in future. This is my short and simple message. Because the enemy is US and Israel, and we must stand against their conspiracies by the power of our self-determination, our vote. The vote power is very strong, and the Iranian nation has showed up their power and their solidarity with their system and the Islamic revolution.
I thank both of you for being with me right here on this news review. Gisu Misha Ahmedi, correspondent right here in the studio with me, and Sabir Abu Mariam, columnist and commentator out of Beirut. The United States and South Korea have kicked off the 10-day annual war games that they insist are defensive in nature. South Korea's defense ministry says the number of troops participating in the exercises is twice as many as last year. They involve air forces from both South Korea and the U.S. South Korean media say the drills could also include American strategic assets. The war games are expected to trigger an angry reaction from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Now, the country considers the drills in the region, with the participation of the U.S., as an existential threat and rehearsals for an invasion. Pyongyang has responded to the provocations by a record number of missile threats in recent months. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
The most recent report was a shocking one, the steep decline in economic activity in Israel, a GDP drop of around 20%, double the estimates that Israel's central bank had announced. The headaches for Israel are multifold, since costs are accumulating rapidly while income generation is not keeping up with the cost. How bad a GDP drop is the topic of this edition of Economic Divide. Some of the headlines we'll be looking at, first of all, this drop in GDP for Israel, it shrunk by a fifth, precisely 19.4%. Double the prediction. Does that mean that there are empty coffers? Something we'll be taking a look at. Next, of course, with the GDP drop, there are certain sectors that are impacted. One of the major ones for Israel is the tech sector. Another sector is the private consumption, which has dropped significantly, negative 26.9%. And another one, for example, import goods and services has dropped by 42.4%. Then the Israeli genocidal war affects. There's been a falling demand, the rising costs, and there are labor shortages.
Israel's economy is in trouble. The regime's onslaught on the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip has cost the regime enormously. According to official figures, Israel's economy shrank by far more than expected in the wake of the onslaught with Hamas in Gaza. Gross domestic product fell by a little over 19% on an annualized basis in the fourth quarter of 2023. It was the single worst quarter for the Israeli economy in terms of GDP per capita since the opening quarter of the COVID pandemic in early 2020. Experts said the data was much worse than had been expected. Exports fell by 18.3% and imports by 42.4%. This was fueled in part by airlines terminating flights and international shipping avoiding the Red Sea. The onslaught had sharply curtailed spending, travel, and investment at the end of last year. Private spending dropped by 26.3%, and there had been a 67.8% slide in investment in fixed assets, especially in residential buildings.
It's time now to take a look at some of the social media posts. First up, Israel's GDP shrank almost 20% in annualized terms in the final quarter of 2023. The drop was caused in part by the call-up of 300,000 reservists. Okay, we got that. That's the topic of the program. This one says Israel's GDP contracted by 19.4% in Q4 on an annualized basis. That's about twice the consensus estimates. That's the key part with this particular entry. Israel Central Bureau of Statistics stated that. Now, this is the important part. Why would Israel not be able to make a projection that's even close? Because twice the consensus estimates is nowhere close to the original estimate. Next, GDP plunged 19.4%, minus 26.9% drop in private consumption. Fixed investment by businesses tumbled by 67.8%. Exports to decline by 18.3%. Palestinian resistance and steadfastness hitting Israel's economy so bad, and it won't be able to keep up with that. Pretty much sums up, I guess, in some way, why there was such a huge GDP contraction. Then we go to this website, which was an analysis that said for Israel's economy, it's one war down, another to go, with a question mark. The figures for how much Israel's GDP contracted at the end of 2023 have been shrugged at as yesterday's news. Hezbollah may not agree. That last point is a pretty important one. Okay, let's bring in our guest for this edition of the program. First up, let's see who we have here. Giorgio Romano. He is the Associate Professor, International Relations and Economics at Federal University, UFABC. Giorgio Romano, welcome to Economic Divide. This steep drop of the Israel's GDP is quite a shocker, one-fifth, 19.4%. It's double what was predicted. And if this is the case, and Israel continues down its path, the quick question becomes, how will it be able to sustain this genocidal war? Netanyahu has rejected the most recent truce proposal, for example, and has remained defiant and wants to continue this genocidal war. What do you think?
Well, on the economy, I mean, it's worth noting that, I mean, the economy in Israel was very bad before the events of October the 7th. Obviously, this isn't going to do it any favours. the extent of this we don't know right now. It's obviously done a huge damage already, and I think there's more coming. I think their economy is doomed beyond belief. There's not going to be much investment. There's going to be no tourism, and no workers, apparently. So I don't know what you do with that. They've never had a normal economy. If they didn't have a sugar daddy like America giving them billions of dollars every year, they wouldn't be able to self-function. And the problem is they've isolated themselves now from the rest of the world. The only people that are supporting Israel are the British and the American governments.
All right, thank you for that. Let me bring in our next guest here. Eamon McKinney joins us. He's an eminent sinologist, Nobel Prize nominee also, and he's written for the Financial Times and The Economist, to name a few. Eamon McKinney, welcome to Economic Divide. The 19.4% fall in the final quarter, the GDP fall, was attributed to the scale of the assault of the genocidal war, and in particular, the impact that it had on the high-tech sector, which contributes to around 17 to 20% of Israel's GDP. But even before this onslaught, our previous guest just mentioned, Israel's economy was not doing that well. There was a drop in investment, and a bulk of the tech workers obviously had to be now reactivated in order to pursue this illegal aggression. Do you think that this sector is going to recoup?
Well, I don't think that the economic problems will make the great difference. There will be enough support from the West, from the United States, if it really comes to a critical situation. It's too early to really evaluate this drop in GDP. I think the main problem in the battlefield will be military and not the economics, because Israel has too many friends and has too many possibilities to resist. It will not be the economics. But, of course, if it takes long time and it will be a distributive problem inside Israel, more people will not defend the Palestinians, but defend another government, which will have another way to deal with the problem.
Time now for the InfoNews section of the program. First up, take a look at the U.S.-EU sanctions leveled against Russia. The two-year special military operation of Russia against Ukraine has arrived, and sanctions were imposed by the U.S. and the EU. In case of the EU, the 13th package of sanctions against Russia, what did it entail? Nearly 200 entities and individuals from Russia were banned from traveling to the EU. Then came in the U.S., the most extensive sanctions, targeting more than 500 people. So much for any improvement in ties between Russia and the EU or the U.S. Next up, poverty in Argentina is what we picked. That rate is at a multiple-year high in January, following the drastic economic reforms that were carried out by the newly installed president, Javier Milei. The share of people in poverty in that country surged to 57.4% in the period last month. That is the highest since the year 2004, and it's up from 44.7% in the third quarter of 2023. The economy of Egypt is our next choice. It's not doing well. Tourism, gas exports, and the Suez Canal revenues, they are all suffering, and the crisis in Rafah could actually make things worse. The crisis that Israel has imposed because of the genocidal war that it's waging against Palestinians. Egypt's economy has suffered from growing public debt, which is at more than 90% of its gross domestic product, and capital flight, and also the currency's fall against the U.S. dollar. And finally, this was a surprise somewhat in terms of the double-digit increase, and it has to deal with Guyana's economy, which recorded a GDP growth of 62.3% for the year 2022, that is. That is the highest in the world, according to the IMF. The 2015 oil discovery made Guyana the world's fastest-growing economy, recording the world's highest real GDP growth rate in 2022 and also for the year 2023. Good for them. Those were the items we picked for this section.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's one of the steepest GDP declines for Israel, almost 20%. The immediate question is whether Israel can withstand and to continue its genocidal war. But how did Israel get to this point anyways? Let's take a look at some of the major indicators. First up, let's take a look at one of the most important factors contributing to this, and that is namely what's called private consumption in terms of the contribution it made to the GDP drop. Now, the private consumption has decreased by a figure of 26.9%. Obviously, that's more than a quarter of the consumption that is now not part of the economy there in Israel. That's from the October to December period. As a matter of fact, this was cited as the major contributor to the GDP drop. Next up, we move to another sector. Obviously, they're all important, but this has really contributed to the setback, and that is the area of imports and exports. In terms of imports, goods and services, the decline there was, gosh, that's a lot, negative 42.4%. And when it comes to exports, you see a decline there of negative 18%. All right, so this was impacted significantly due to the actions by the Yemeni army in the Red Sea area in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. So you have to also keep that in mind in terms of how that has impacted imports and exports. Now, the other area that saw a steep contraction was in the investment sector. The impact there is quite high. This obviously impacts the economy in a big way. It is 67.8%. It happened in fixed assets, especially in the residential building area, and obviously residential construction being part of that, which ground to a halt. This amid a shortage of both Israeli and Palestinian workers. Now, we're going to now take a look at one of the consequences, and that's the spending by this cabinet. The spending had to be high, but how high is high? Well, this figure is about to shock you in terms of the time the Operation Al-Aqsa flood took place. 88.1% are the war costs. I mean, you're talking from reservists to military spending, obviously, to business closures and bankruptcies, unemployment. Well, the list is rather long when it comes to this area in terms of the expenses for the cabinet. Then this is what's said to be the major reason, and that is the cost of the reservists and calling up of these reservists, as well as the lower employee productivity that came as a result of that, which happened in some sectors. When you have 400,000 reservists that were called up, well, the cost came out to roughly $630 million per week. Based on one of the reports, that amounted to $3.6 billion per month. That's the cost just on 1 month that had to deal with the reservists being called up. These are reservists that were also pulled out of the economic cycle. So obviously with that figure, we can see how deep an impact that has had. Let's try to see if our guests can break this down a little bit for us. Let's bring them back. We have first Giorgio Romano, who rejoins us. Giorgio Romano is an associate professor at the International Relations and Economics Federal University, UFABC. Giorgio Romano, welcome back to Economic Divide. Where can I start with you on Israelis? Economic problems. You got the cost of the war, you got the credit downgrade, you got the lack of workers, and a host of other negative economic indicators, too much to mention in one breath. And of course, you add to that the Red Sea tensions and the international standing ruined. Does Israel have any hopes of a recovery?
I don't see a way back. I think their economy is destroyed beyond recognition. You're seeing the people of the world are essentially looking at this and saying, how is this allowed to happen? It's just the devil now for all to see. So you're seeing massive boycotts of Israeli goods and all kinds of Israeli services. So it's imploding upon itself. The wrath of the world is against Israel for what's going on. And it's disgraceful. But no, I don't see a way back for Israel. I don't see a new normal for Israel. Let me put it like that. It's very clear that they're trying to provoke wider wars in the region. And that's just going to lead to more hostility.
Okay, let's find out what our next guest thinks. Eamon McKinney rejoins us. He's a eminent Sinologist and Nobel Prize nominee who has written for the Financial Times and The Economist. Eamon McKinney, welcome back to the program. Our guest there talked about a pretty dark scenario for Israel in terms of recovery, if it can even do that. You have many different negative economic indicators that are impacting Israel's economy. What are the chances of this recovery, and what form do you think it'll take for Israel to actually bounce back? I mean, the groundwork is not there right now as we see it.
Yeah, well, the issue of the migrant workers is, of course, direct and critical, because Israel dependent, paradoxically, on daily cheap labor of the Palestinians, except the West Bank and the West Crossing, and I think also on Gaza, and for in the construction and service. And what they will do, and what they're already doing, is just change the Palestinian workers for from India, Sri Lanka, whatever. They will look for other countries, Bangladesh, they will look for other countries, because that will create a problem in the, you know, day-to-day economic functioning. They're really dependent on this cheap labor. Once they are substituted, of course, at some point this war will, of course, this phase of the war will end. And you have another problem in the West Bank, but it means that even after there is some kind of deal, the Palestinian workers will not be allowed to go back again, because they will be substituted. So there will be the structural changes in this, and this increases social problems, unemployment in the West Bank, of course, also.
The construction sector in Israel has suffered from a lack of labor due to military call-ups and reduction in Palestinian workers. The Israeli military had called up over 300,000 reservists in the days following the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood operation, and the regime immediately barred the entry of at least 170,000 Palestinian laborers, who made up a considerable portion of the construction and agriculture workforce. Regime spending, mainly on the onslaught expenses, and compensation for businesses and households jumped by 88.1%. Despite the sharp drop in GDP between October and December, Israel's economy grew by 2% for the full year. However, it had been expected to expand by 3.5%. The contraction of Israel's economy was much worse than had been expected, and highlights the extent of the hit from the Hamas and the onslaught in Gaza. The regime's growth outlook for 2024 now looks likely to post one of its weakest rates on record. About 20% of the Israeli workforce was missing from the labor market in October, up from 3% before the fighting began. The spike in unemployment reflects the fact that about 900,000 people are now either enlisted in the army, unemployed at home, to have fled from settlements where attacks have been concentrated, or are unable to work due to the destruction of the work industry.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Mahdi Abbasian. In this section, we will look at the labor force issue in Israel and also inconsistencies in Israel's announcement when it comes to its economy. Initially, about 400,000 Israeli reservists were mobilized to go fight in the Gaza Strip. The number that was reported to be in action, however, was 300,000. Then Israel announced that it was subsidizing the salaries of an average of more than 200,000 reservists. The other burden that Israel has overtaken is the evacuees. 250,000 Israelis, and the Israeli sponsorship of housing was for more than 120,000. These were Israelis evacuated from the northern and southern border areas of occupied Palestine. Then there is the issue of restriction of Palestinian workers from the Israeli workforce. There are inconsistencies in these numbers. One report indicated that 125,000 were restricted, while another said 175,000. But another stat indicated that this crisis had led to the loss of approximately 208,000 jobs. Now, here is the part that gets confusing. We figure it is best to break this down to see how Israel's workforce has been impacted. Here is a breakdown of the labor market numbers. 1,275,000 workers were taken out of a total workforce of around 5 million. This amounts to around 25% of the workforce. The official unemployment rate, 4.58% annually, with a record low of 2.84% in November 2023. There are other factors as well that are inconsistent with the announcements, but what is for sure is how this genocidal war is coming in at a high cost for Israel. That does it for this Quick Take section.
The figures coming out of Israel point to an economy that is trying to survive. All major economic indicators point towards a long road ahead for a possible recovery. The tech sector, Israel's bright spot, well, that has been hit severely from manpower to investment. But like Moody's credit ratings agency indicated, there's a lack of confidence in Israel overall due to an uncertain future, especially with the specter of a war looming over the horizon. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thank you so much for tuning in. From Ikava Tarwe and the entire team at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
Returns to our camp riderless.
أزور سيدي ومولاي ومعتمدي ورجاي.
The ocean of dua.
الإمام الحسين عليه السلام زيارة مني ونيابة عن والدي.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves, Hussein, Hussein, the slain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of Ziyaratu Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Ziyaratu al-Ashura. So stay with us.
لقد عظم مصابي بك فأسأل الله الذي أكرم مقامك وأكرمني بك أن يرزقني طلب ثأرك مع إمام منصور من أهل بيت محمد صلى الله عليه وآله.
Brothers and sisters, we were discussing this part of Ziyaratul Ashura. بِأَبِي أَنْتَ وَأُمِّي لَقَدْ عَظُمَ مُصَابِي بِكْ. May my father and mother be sacrificed for you. Indeed, my affliction due to what happened to you is immense. فَأَسْأَلُ اللَّهَ الَّذِي أَكْرَمَ مَقَامَكْ. Therefore, I ask Allah, who venerated your station, وَأَكْرَمَنِي بِكْ, and honored me, أَنْ يَرْزُقَنِي طَلَبَ ثَارِكْ, to provide me with the succor to avenge for your blood with a supported leader, مع إمام منصور من أهل بيت محمد, from the family of Muhammad, صلى الله عليه وآله. May Allah pour down His mercy on him and his progeny. Regarding the first part, بأبي أنت وأمي, as we discussed in the previous episode, desire in this part, by saying this, this tafdiya expression, declares that he gives preference to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, to his actions, to his deeds, to his words, over his beloved ones in his life. Now, this part continues, لقد عظم مصابي بك. Indeed, my affliction due to what happened to you is immense. The particle lam in لقد عظم مصابي بك shows that the Tsar is swearing, that the Tsar believes that the calamity that has befallen him is indeed immense and severe. So, لقد عظم مصابي بك, this shows the severity of this affliction. This emphasizes the vastness of this incident. The word musab in this phrase, لقد عظم مصابي بك, is translated as affliction. So it is as if we are saying لقد عظم مصابي بك means my affliction indeed due to what happened to you is immense. So we are declaring the immensity of our affliction due to what happened to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. A natural consequence of such a situation is deep anguish. It's deep sorrow. Expressing our state of intense affliction of sorrow, however, should be natural. It should be tangible. In order to realize this, we have to pass through two important stages. We have to have proper knowledge. As we also say, whenever the one who is supplicating wants his supplication to be responded to, the very first condition for him is to know the one whom he invokes, the one whom he has turned to. So in this case, this is also true. Proper knowledge means the accurate knowledge about the personality of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We have to know the details of the tragedy of Karbala in order for us to have this great sorrow within ourselves. And the second stage is true love. Intense love and attachment for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, such that we feel united with Imam. Such that we consider Imam's loss as our own loss, or rather, even greater. That's why we say, بِأَبِي أَنْتَ وَأُمِّي, may my father, may my mother be sacrificed for you.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right, or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies, it clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is do not allow tyranny, do not allow evil doing, do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah, he appreciates Him, he understands His dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we are talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So brothers and sisters, when we see the kind of sensation used in this part, the kind of sentiment that says, لَقَدْ عَظُمَ مُصَابِي بِكَ, indeed my affliction due to what happened to you is immense, added with the previous part, بِأَبِي أَنْتَ وَأُمِّي, may my father and mother be sacrificed for you, we realize that this presentation, this expressing of our state, this affliction, this sorrow, this should be tangible. This should be real and natural. So we say, in the beginning, we have to have the proper knowledge, the accurate knowledge about the personality of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, which is the epitome of the religion. And of course, true love. We have to present our true love for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And we will describe each of these steps in order to familiarize ourselves with the personality of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, so that we can feel that sense of musab even more. So, regarding proper knowledge, unfortunately, sometimes the fundamental aim of conveying the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is forgotten. Instead of introducing his sublime character, instead of narrating a reliable account of his tribulations, so that a natural flow of tears ensure and continue, some try to relate inauthentic records to ensure that the listeners are able to weep well. Some noble scholars in this regard, in order to avoid deviation and misquotation, try to read a reliable maqtal so that the listeners get accurate information, so that the listeners weep on the basis of truth. This is what Imam Hussein alayhi salam, after all, died for. This is the Imam Hussein is the epitome of truth. So we say to everyone to read the words of lamentation from the text of the book itself. This is highly recommended if we want our listeners to listen carefully and weep on the basis of truth, to reach the inner and real meaning of this part. لَقَدْ عَظُمَ مُصَابِي بِكَ, indeed my affliction due to what happened to you is immense. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
أنت الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.